which is a student deferment. With the shortage of potential, shall we say, recruits, the federal government was changing its policy, and now they were going to ask academic institutions to provide grade points for students, and that was going to have a determination on one's 2S deferment. So that May of 1966, there was a sit-in at the University of Wisconsin Administration Building protesting the university's complying with the selective service system in providing academic standing and grades for the students. It ended after 3-4 days. It ended peacefully, and to the regret of a number of Madison officials, particularly in the police department, they were not brought in to remove the students. Now let's fast forward to 1967. Exactly this week, 68 years ago, I guess, and that was what was referred to as the Dow demonstration. The University of Wisconsin was utilizing academic buildings for private companies to have interviews to recruit students who might work for them. As a protest against the war, a lot of us thought that it was inappropriate to take public facilities and utilize them for private companies doing their recruitment. Dow was a manufacturer of napalm, and at that point, we all knew what napalm did. They were also the manufacturer of Agent Orange, and most people, including those participating in the demonstration at that time, did not know what Agent Orange did. So there was a lot of controversy at the time as to exactly what happened that led to the bloody confrontation in October of 1967. There were basically two competing descriptions of what happened when the Madison Police Department came to the doors of the Commerce Building. And it wasn't until many, many years later that, at least in my mind, it was definitively resolved as to what happened, as one officer at that time was to repeatedly say, the university administration told us to remove the students from the building. They did not tell us how. And that pretty much confirms that the police came in probably wanting to make up for the failure of the administration building in 1966, where they were not called in to clear the students away. So, following the Dow demonstration, where thousands and thousands of students, and one of the stupidest things that ever happened, you have students coming out of classes, 120 classes, for that 15-minute break before 2:25. That's the busiest time atop Bascom Hill, and that's when the police decided to release the tear gas. I think even they regretted that. In any case, I was called by Dean Ginsburg to an invitation to join him, a police inspector, and Bill Dyke, who'd been a candidate in 1967, was elected mayor in 1969. I was invited to join them because there'd been a number of invitations from people throughout the Madison community that wanted to hear what were the issues and what was underlying that Dow demonstration. We ended up going to a number of churches, a number of civic organizations, civic clubs, and as that winter of 67 unfolded going into November, December, and January of 68, I came to realize it was futile to explain to people why we sat in if they didn't even understand what the war in Vietnam was about. That there was just this enormous gulf. Now, if we talk about the late 60s and the early 70s in regards to political activism, probably the two organizations that come to mind are SDS and the Black Panthers. And probably the lasting image of those two organizations is that SDS broke into a number of splintered groups, including the Weathermen, what was called RIM 1, RIM 2, and were involved in a lot of very violent street action. The image of the Black Panthers was of young African-American men wearing berets, wearing leather jackets, and holding rifles. Lost in that history is what I think is one of the most important movements in America that was to have a tremendous influence on this country for the next several decades. One was SDS's ERAP, E-R-A-P, ERAP program, and I can't remember what the initials stand for, ERAP, economic something. Anyway, we'll look it up on your cell phones. So people from SDS, including many of the original founders like Tom Hayden, Todd Gitlin, went into some cities like Newark, New Jersey, Philadelphia, Cleveland, Chicago, Oakland, California. And it's interesting because if you look at the politics of those cities at that time, Philadelphia and Cleveland had two of the most right-wing, vicious mayors who represented their cities. Chicago had Mayor Daley. Oakland, California's entire city council was Republican. Now, at the same time, the Black Panthers were doing similar work in many of these same cities. What was common is that they were working on childcare, healthcare, free lunch and breakfast programs. They were doing community organizing. Chicago had three groups working at the time. There was the Black Panthers. There was the Young Lords, which had grown out of a Latino street gang. And there was the Young Patriots. The Young Patriots in Uptown were basically either coming straight from or the descendants of the coal miners in Appalachia, many of them from Eastern Kentucky and West Virginia. One anecdote, which I think is very telling of the times, is that they had several conferences. And at that first conference, the Young Patriots, principally white Southern Atlantic coast, show up in their colors, which include Confederate flags, which are sewn onto their jackets. It would be interesting to reflect on what would happen today if there was such a conference. Because I don't think today we would have seen what happened back in 1969, the first time they all met. The Panthers sat down with them and explained why the Confederate flag was offensive. A year later, they assembled again. Everybody showed up, and the Young Patriots showed up without the Confederate flags. It seemed that talking and discussion and understanding was key in terms of building this diverse group racially and ethnically in terms of transcending any differences that they might have. So there I was, in the winter of 67, 68, seeing this enormous gulf between what we were doing on campus and the understanding of the larger community, and having some appreciation for the community organizing that was taking place in these other cities. So I figured, okay, this is the direction to go. And decided at that point to run for the city council. That's what got me into politics. I saw elected office as a vehicle for organizing. And in those early years, and through for certainly the 6 years after I was elected mayor in 1973, what were the kinds of things that I got involved in? There was a number of low-income women and their children living in a series of houses on Williamson Street that were slated to be torn down, and they were to be displaced, and because it was privately owned property, there was no obligation to relocate them. That was the first time I had an opportunity to work with the WRO, the Welfare Rights Organization. Fortunately, Mayor Fesky at the time vetoed the condemnation of those buildings, and we had, by the margin of just one vote, enough votes on the Madison City Council to uphold his veto, so it never went through. That began a working relationship that led to the next issue of some importance, and that had to do with the People's Health Clinic. The same women from the WRO had hooked up with the UW Medical School and were working on a clinic for low-income families, and this was key to it, that was, among other things, going to provide services regarding reproductive rights. Just 2 years ago, I went to the funeral for one of the women, Sharon Black, and when you walked in, there was this huge bowl of condoms. And her oldest daughter said to me, she said, "I never could figure my mother out. She had condoms for everybody, but she also had seven children." So anyway, Sharon was one of the important players. My point is that as these issues arose from households and families and people who were pretty much out of the mainstream of power, this is the kind of issues that my colleagues and I on the city council, Ollie Ashman, Gene Parks, Joe Thompson, Susan K. Phillips, and I would take an advance in terms of our agenda. We didn't have an agenda of our own. Our agenda was generated and created by the needs of the people of the community. At that point, while I was still on the city council, and I never had an appreciation of this until after I got elected mayor, we were in a running battle with Mayor Dyke over public transportation. The Madison Bus Company, privately owned, was failing. And there were a group of us that wanted to use a federal program to acquire the bus company, buy new buses, and set up what is today Madison Metro in the city. When it came time to do polling in that 1973 election, Steve Chafee, who is a university journalism professor who was very expert at polling, came to me as we approached the primary election and said, "In terms of you and Bill Dyke, there's only two issues in this election. Nothing else counts. One is your personalities, And two is public transportation. The only real issue which people were making a decision who weren't already set ideologically one way or the other was public transit. When we got involved in that issue, none of us were thinking about elections, using it to accomplish something. We used it because it was important. And it turned out it also determined the future of the city. Now, one of the key influences to the work that the Black Panthers were doing, SDS was doing, the Young Lords, the Young Patriots, and was to have a considerable influence on my work in those years, was that of Saul Alinsky, who had written Rules for Radicals. And one of the key rules was never do for people what they can do for themselves. And another aspect of what he wrote was that people know what is important to them. And as I looked at whether we were talking about organizing on campus or organizing in a larger city, as I used to say to folks, you can't get students involved on the intricacies of a university administration decision about grades and the selective service system until you address their needs at their level. Quality of food in the dormitories is where you start. Something very basic that people understand. And it was the same thing in terms of talking about the war in Vietnam. It's interesting because there were some meetings between Alinsky and these young organizers which didn't go well. And that was shortly before Alinsky died of a heart attack in the early 70s. But the lasting point is the influence that he had in terms of organizing, in terms of its consequences long term. So now let's go to Arlie Hochschild's book, Stolen Pride. I want to leave you with two thoughts about her book. First is her explanation as to why people vote for candidates who are using them and in no way are looking out for their best interests. How do you explain that? And here's what she says. We're all in line. We're in a queue. And what's going on is that there's been some people, Democrats, people going back to Bill Clinton, to Barack Obama, Joe Biden, and they've been signaling to certain people, you can cut around the line. Come on, go to the front of the line. And along comes somebody like Donald Trump, and he says, wait a second, I'm the new monitor. Nobody's getting ahead of you in the line. And that is so powerful that as long as folks believe that nobody's going to cut ahead of them in the line, regardless of their race, their gender, their ethnic background, their religion, doesn't matter to them that a Donald Trump is not going to really make their lives better. It's just that nobody's cutting the line in front of them. So how did this come about? And what Arlie says in her book, and this is her second book, by the way, and I want to go back to her first book in a second. What she says is, if you go into these old mining communities, and she selected the poorest county in the United States for her research, which is in eastern Kentucky. What's been going on? Groups affiliated with, shall we say, ultra-conservative views have been doing organizing. They've been running health programs. They've been running child care programs. They've been running food programs. And while Saul Alinsky wrote Rules for Radicals, there's actually a conservative book called Reveal for Radicals, where some conservatives said, some of those organizing techniques that were used in the 60s and 70s worked. Why can't we do the same thing? In the meantime, if you look at those cities where that original organizing was done, there's been a tremendous transformation. Now, some of the transformation is demographic. Whites fleeing to the suburbs, those cities becoming more diverse racially and ethnically. But if you look at the city councils and the mayors in Newark, Cleveland, Philadelphia, Chicago wasn't a straight line. You get Harold Washington, and then you get backsliding to the second Richard Daley. But then you look at the last two mayors, and then you go all the way out to Oakland. It had profound impacts long-term on those communities and on their states. What I would suggest is that those principles of organizing have been lost. And where we're at now is in this, every 2 years, this battle to get to 50% plus one. And it's not working. And why? Because we're no longer doing the kind of work that got us so far ahead for a while. Now, I can't recall Arlie Hochschild's first book. It came out at the same time as here at the University of Wisconsin, The Politics of Resentment was written by, is that Kramer? I think it was Kathleen Kramer. So she wrote, Hochschild, yes.
Strangers in Their Own Land.
Thank you. Strangers in Their Own Land. In her first book, she goes to New Orleans, into the bayous, goes into Louisiana. And she tells this story about this fellow who works in a chemical plant. One of his jobs is to take these huge metal containers of chemicals and dump them in the bayou. Meantime, he and his family and all of his friends and neighbors are getting cancer. The hunting and fishing is all gone to hell. But he's solid in supporting Donald Trump. And again, while she doesn't articulate it in the first book, as she does in the second about the line jumping, she makes it very clear in studying the folks and interviewing them, that from the standpoint of many people, they are not supporting and endorsing candidates who would be in their best self-interest. There's one other thing that I think has been a tragic mistake going back to the 70s. And it's an overcorrection that was made. That overcorrection had to deal with how we teach history and civics in our public schools. The criticism was correct that the history and the civics classes being taught at that time was inadequate and didn't tell the real story of the history of this country. It didn't tell the story about the first Illegal Alien Act, which we adopted within a decade of becoming a country. It didn't tell the story of black people not allowed to own property, the Jim Crow laws, how in effect the institution of slavery survived after the Civil War. It didn't tell that. And so what happened is in our public schools, U.S. history and civics was dropped as a required class, and other classes were offered. Other classes might have been on black history, or students didn't take any history and civics classes at all. And that was a mistake. What should have been done is those classes should have been taught correctly. And as in some instances they are, we're now seeing government officials trying to sanitize and go back to that version of U.S. history that was taught prior to the 1980s. As a result, the respect for institutions, the respect for some of the unwritten rules of governance about the role of the minority, about respect for free speech, have been lost. So while we entitled today's subject, My Experience as Mayor, I thought it would be a little more important only to focus on what's relevant to today. There's a lot more anecdotally I could share with you about those years as mayor. And I do want to, I think as I conclude, do share one more, which I guess is very appropriate for this building. One of the things that I had to do as mayor was hold together divergent interests. Coalitions. I had very strong support from women. Part of it going back to the work with the Welfare Rights Organization, part of it with the work with the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, which had been a big core of my base. And I also had a very strong relationship with the labor unions, particularly the firefighters, who had gone on strike in 1969 because of disparate treatment and wages between them and police officers. So about 1976, we had already made profound changes in the police department. Chief Cooper was hiring a very diverse workforce. Women officers were no longer assigned strictly to juvenile and what was referred to as sensitive crimes. They were doing all aspects of law enforcement. The force included men and women of color, gays, lesbians, but the fire department had been a little slow in this area. It was time to make some changes in the fire department. And it meant a clash between two of the bases for the organizing that we had done, because the firefighters union was adamantly opposed to women joining the service. Judith Pedersen, who had served on the Affirmative Action Commission and had been very influential, as I used to put it, show her a glass ceiling and she'd ask for a hammer. And so I wanted to put her on the Police and Fire Commission, which makes the final decisions on hirings. And so we had a really drawn out, protracted fight on her appointment. And there were 22 members of the City Council at that time. The vote ended up being 11 to 11. And as the mayor, I got to break the tie on my own appointment. And Judith succeeded. Within another year, women were in the recruit classes. The first recruit class failed, which is another story altogether. But 2 years later, the first women firefighters as permanent employees joined the force. I think what I just described here in conclusion is another key element that can't be ignored, which is you build a base, whether it was the Young Lords, the Black Panthers, and the Young Patriots, whether it was a solid base of progressive women and unions, eventually there is going to be a clash in terms of values and opinions. And it can't be ignored, it has to be addressed, and hopefully you can hold it together. As it was, labor and medicine, both the teachers and firefighters, becoming far more progressive. The last hold out wasn't the firefighters, it was the building trades. There's still issues with the building trades. So let me stop there. I don't know how we're going to proceed here with questions. Yes. Well, the job is a lot more difficult today than it was 70 years ago. And that's simply because of the internet. And I really believe that the internet shapes beliefs and changes the brain. And two words come to mind, shame and sarcasm. I think that the amount of sarcasm and shaming that take place when people do not interface with one another, but can hide anonymously behind a screen, conditions them to do that in the less frequent in-person meetings that they have with other people. And so consequently, what we've got is we have to first go down to that level. And what I would do is I would attempt to say, we're going to have free speech in this conversation, but there's two things you can't do. You can't shame, and you can't be sarcastic. If we go back to that initial meeting between the Black Panthers and the Young Patriots, which could have been so close if it hadn't been handled right, I think in the Black Panthers, it's fair to change somebody, not to shame them, not to embarrass them. And if we look at it from the standpoint of the Young Patriots, they valued to a greater degree building this coalition to obtain a common goal than their heritage. and what that Confederate flag represented. I don't do that stuff anymore. I don't have to deal with it. And I appreciate it. But I think that's the key, is how we communicate, and it has to be in person. It cannot be on the internet. It can't be in chat groups. And I just go back to an article that was in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago. It had to deal with this generation's difficulty in romantic relationships, because they don't know how to do interchange with people face to face. It's not the fault of the baby boomers. It's the fact that they don't interact with each other.
Paul, thank you for this talk. At one time, you were a young college student. I'm sure you remember it. And what I'm trying to figure out is what characteristics you had at that time, or personality trait, that you would attribute to the way you've lived your life.
Well, it's interesting that you ask that question. I never rebelled against my family, my parents. And I think how I was raised had a lot to do with it. My parents were political activists. My father had refused to sign a loyalty oath for the Chicago public school system when he was teaching. And my guess is that it was that family environment that created values in terms of free speech, in terms of understanding, in terms of differences. As I've said before, there were many of us, not all of us, but there were many of us, by the way, I've been thrown out of the baby boomers. When I was growing up, baby boomers were born in 1945 and afterwards. Now I've learned baby boomers were born in 1946 and afterwards. So I'm no longer a baby boomer. But in any case, those of us who grew up after World War II, in the shadow of the war, were repeatedly, not all of us, but some of us were repeatedly taught why we fought. Why we fought World War II, and basically came out of our high school experiences in the 50s and 60s believing it, believing the values of what the Allies stood for as opposed to the Axis. And Sarah turned her phone off, and I forgot to turn mine off. Sorry. So anyway, I think that's what had a lot to do with it. I remember as a child, we were at a beach in Indiana, and this police officer in uniform comes walking across the sand and points to this man in the water and calls him out and tells him to leave. And I turned to my mother and I said, "What's that about?" And she said, "Well, it's because he's a Negro." And having grown up in an integrated, and that's another thing, by the way, I grew up in an integrated neighborhood. Not only were there white and black kids, but I didn't learn this till after we left the neighborhood, but I finally found out why there were so many Japanese kids in our school. The relocation of the Nisi. Many were sent to our neighborhood. And so I think those are the kinds of experiences. And for that, I'm very grateful. And I think that had a lot to do with it. I think, in the simplest terms, I could say, is the economy stupid? I think a large part of it is economic, and so I think it's economic and social justice. That fairness and figuring out what to do about the line. For those who are in that line, the backgrounds, their families, their educational opportunities, their health opportunities, their access to food, all of those affect where we are in the line. And I think what we've got to do is understand we're in a line, whether it's for jobs or for housing or whatever, and we're going to have some kind of understanding of the needs of other people who are in that line. And are we willing to do something about it? That's the other critical point. It's not just recognizing it, it's what are you willing to do about it? You know, if you talk, you know, if you think about it in terms of the 1960s, the early 70s, and you bring it up to today in the old coal mining areas of West Virginia and Kentucky, or you look up downstate Illinois and what's become of Cairo, Illinois. I went through there a few years ago, and it's just incredible to look at what used to be a vibrant city. And you can relate to the experience of those families and then get them to relate to the experience of a family that's in the Lawndale area of Illinois or parts of Milwaukee. That's what needs to be done. That's where the conversation has to go. Things like what happened yesterday with the No Kings rally, I think are very important in terms of keeping up the spirit and the energy of those who are already committed. I am not sure that they build the base. I'm not sure about that. And that's why I keep coming back to organizing. Well, I think your question really goes back to the very first question. Another article I read this week, I think the headline on it was, "Is a college education worth it?" Why do we discuss college educations only in terms of the income from the job it produces? Why aren't we talking about education in terms of enlightenment, in terms of understanding? That is something that's really changed over the last 20 or 30 years. You know, if economic success is where it's at, there's no question there's some better things you can do than a college education. But where I come from, that was not the purpose of an education. The purpose of an education was understanding. The purpose of an education, even though that wasn't the subject of what he said, is what Atticus says to Scout. You have to walk around in someone else's shoes. You have to understand other people. And that's the great failure. And that's where we ought to be going, the purpose of an education. And I want to be critical of homeschooling, but homeschooling is also part of the problem, because it means that the student is not interacting and involved with other people who are different. So let me ask, how many people here have gone to any of the Capital Times Idea Fests in recent years? A couple of folks? Okay. I had the same response today, the last time I went to the Idea Fest. We're all so old.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a few people here I suspect might be under the age of 55, but not a lot. And that goes back to the whole internet thing. These conversations are taking place among old people. And these conversations have to take place among younger folk. And when I follow these conversations, radio shows that I might tune into these days or podcasts, the conversation that we are having is not being had by people who are under the age of 40 or 50. Mm-hmm. It's this. Whether they're on the left or on the right. And I think that's another part of the problem. We have to do that, but I'd argue we got another job we have to do first. And that other job we have to do first is that organizing so that this country is not sitting on the outside as we are under the Trump administration on everything from the Paris Accords to working with the UN. I think the highest priority right now is to create that political base so that we have a government that can speak with credibility on the international stage on those issues. But right now we can't. We have no voice. I'm in agreement. Cell phones should be put away in the classroom. We're not disciplined enough in our household, our kids and I, and we're all still at the dinner table. I do my best to, in fact, I even leave the house at times, or I'll leave the cell phone at another end of the house. And I think the reason why among the left you're seeing opposition to it is it's because it's among the leaders who have gotten to where they are because of their very effective use of their cell phones. And so what they're failing to do is relate to a larger issue, which is the role of those electronics in terms of shaping and forming ideas in other ways. And it goes back, I think it was that article that I was referring to about kids having such an awkward time dating. I think it was in the New York Times. But it's fascinating that these kids don't know how to relate to one another. Very little in the private sector. My father was a high school teacher and later a university professor, so he was completely in the public sector, except for his own little tutoring business, and I wouldn't call that private sector. And while my mother was in the private sector, it's not what we would really consider to be influential that way, though she was influential. She managed the children's book department at Chaucer Books in Santa Barbara, California, where obviously it was a private job, but I don't see it as a private sector job. I must say that people would come into the bookstore and just enjoy telling this story. People come into the bookstore looking for books for their children and their grandchildren, and my mother would tell us what was going on, and she couldn't understand and we couldn't understand the different reactions. She didn't think it was a big deal. We did, when she'd tell us that Julia Child or Robert Mitchum came in and she took care of them as they were looking for books for their kids and grandchildren. But that's the extent of private sector. Your question about the electronics got broken up a bit, but I want to share an observation that I made prior to the internet and cell phones. So let's go back to, say, about 1980. So 1975, which was the bicentennial. So this nation and the documents, the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence at that point were about 250 years old. And in terms of society's social structures, there hadn't been much change. But if you look at the scientific advancements that had taken place over the 200 years, 250 years now, they were incredibly profound. Things going on that Thomas Jefferson never could have envisioned. And part of the problem is that we as people, in terms of dealing with our interactions with one another, with our government, with corporations, have been very immature in terms of responding to the structure of those scientific changes. There's an incredible contradiction among the conservatives in the U.S. Supreme Court on what's referred to as originalism, which is, they say, when it comes to interpreting the Constitution, including the Bill of Rights and the amendments, we have to think in terms of what the authors said at that time, several hundred years ago. So they say it's inappropriate to look at modern issues dealing with race and society, ethnic issues, the kinds of data that sociologists come up with in terms of interpreting the Constitution. We have to go back to the 1770s, the 1780s, the 1790s. When it comes to the Second Amendment, they don't have that philosophy. Because if you were to adopt that philosophy regarding the Second Amendment, Congress could pass no laws prohibiting you from owning your musket and your 16th century cannon. But then again, we don't use that interpretation when it comes to the tremendous firepower we see in the weapons that are available to any household today. And so I think the problem stems from the fact that we haven't figured out how to be organized as a society in this immense technical scientific advancement that's occurred over the last several hundred years since our government was formed. And I don't have an answer to that except to say it's obviously a problem. We see it all the time in terms of the internet, in terms of cell phones, conflicts in terms of free speech, and all the issues we're now seeing in terms of the impacts emotionally, physically, psychologically, whether it's something like a suicide that is prompted from online bullying, or it's what's referred to as swatting, where somebody will call in police to somebody else's home. So no answer there, just the recognition of a problem.
Well, we really appreciate you coming, Paul.
Thank you.
Interesting. Thank you.